You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we are joined this morning by Jov Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State, columnist with Seattle Weekly.
I used to do this all the time.
it's so lonely in here now.
It's
just the two of us. We got rid of Maria. No, she is on assignment this week. I love it when they say that on TV shows and newspapers and whatnot. So and so is on assignment. Why doing a story on the posture of Tahitian natives while they serve them tie dyes. But she actually had minor surgery yesterday and is at home recuperating. And she'll be back next week. So we wish her well, and we miss her. But by goodness, detailing what's wrong with the world and what to do about it must go on. So.
Yes, we must plow ahead as so many things are going wrong.
Oh, ain't that the truth?
It's amazing. Every time you think that
worse is usually up to the challenge. Yeah. Never ever say it can't get worse. They take that as a sort of a raising of the bar and a challenge. And by goodness, they can usually meet it, especially with this crew in charge of things.
So let's talk about Iraq. And
yeah, it was a heck of a week. We had folks who tuned in a few minutes ago heard on Counterspin earlier this week, the entire apparatus of the Bush White House, as well as the Democratic congressional leadership, as well as most of the Me Too punditry in the Beltway and among the major networks and major newspapers in the country, all out of hand, dismissed Iraq, the Iraqi government. People say Saddam Hussein for shorthand, but I think it's time that we start not saying this is a war against Saddam Hussein and keep reminding people this is an entire country of 23 million people that we are attacking. It is not one person. That's a very important verbal distinction, because that's one way to hide the fact that a great many people would die in this war if it happened.
And one of them would not be Saddam Hussein.
No. It's funny how people like Saddam Hussein and George Bush are always the last people to be hurt by these kind of excursions. But and a great many people outside the country of Iraq as well, and we'll get to that in a bit. But It was astonishing when Iraq, which did not throw out weapons inspectors 4 years ago, they were withdrawn by the UN with the advance knowledge of U.S. and British bombing raids, and then were not let back in by Iraq after revelations that the U.S. had used the teams for spy purposes. Now, this is a history that is well known, well confirmed, and is absolutely missing from every account, virtually every account in mainstream media in this country. That it was actually a pretty reasonable posture by the Iraqi government at the time. You guarantee there aren't any spies in your inspection teams and we'll let them back in. But they said unconditional inspections, which is what the U.S. had been demanding, and not surprisingly at all, the Bush administration was not willing to take yes for an answer. Because they want this war far worse than it's not about weapons inspections. Weapons inspections is the last thing this war is about. But what was particularly astonishing is that, the congressional Democratic leadership fell right in line. Here's Tom Daschle and Richard Gephardt saying exactly the same things. You had, bless her heart and soul, Medea Benjamin, harassing Donald Rumsfeld a few days ago in his hearing. And then, she and some other folks were on the lawn of Tom Daschle the other morning with pots and pans and coffee, trying to give him a wake-up call at his home in suburban D.C. So
I missed that.
Yeah, it was quite amusing. So she's got a flair for the camera, that Medea does. It really is quite astonishing that among the leadership of both the Democrats and the Republicans, people really seem to want this war, even though there are a lot of doubts among the American public. Give our own congressperson, Jim McDermott, a lot of credit for standing up on the floor of the House of Representatives and really actually not just questioning the rationale for the war, but saying flat out, it's about oil, it's about imperialism, it's about American empire. I don't think he used that last phrase, but, it's being used everywhere else in the world, so why not use it here? Give him credit for that. But this is a point in time at which I really think everybody listening to this show should be spending their spare moments, maybe some moments that they don't consider to be spare, you know, not just emailing, because emails just get tallied, and sometimes they don't even get tallied, although, I mean, there's a... I'll get to that in a second, but phone calls, faxes, visits to offices, either with appointments or without, and either with the willingness to leave or not. You know, we should be doing everything possible to do two things. One, to pressure our elected representatives, because there will be a vote coming up in Congress. But two, don't count on that vote in Congress to not give the White House a blank check for any war that they want, because historically it did before the Gulf War, which was a much more contentious debate than what we're having so far right now, over a much longer period of time than that opposition is going to be given a chance to develop this time. And when the vote got close, as it did in 1990, you know, the Bush senior administration pulled out all the stops to basically buy enough votes to win fairly narrow approval for what turned out to be the Gulf of War. That process would certainly happen again. But lobbying so that we have enough congressional opposition to at least raise the level of the debate would be an incredibly important contribution to what is necessary in order to derail this war express, if it's going to stop. The second component of that is that there just has to be massive public opposition, and it has to be across the board. I mean, the people who are most concerned about this war at this point are liberal progressives and a lot of military people, a lot of very conservative hawks who see this as a military disaster, who see it as a bad precedent for military reasons, and they're absolutely right too. Those groups need to be working together, and you know, people in the center need to be working with both of them. You know, it's sort of time to put aside the other agendas and, you know, forget about making sure that the poster gets printed on recycled hemp paper or whatever it is, and, you know, just go out there and agitate.
Right. People should be calling their reps, you know, at least every week, you know, and constantly and writing them and like you say, thanking McDermott because he needs the support.
Yeah. And there's no reason why the other, like our two Democratic senators should be all over this. Now, neither Maria Cantwell nor Patty Murray have a track record of being profiles in courage, particularly when it comes to military and foreign affairs. But that's no reason not to call them. I mean, you know, the opposition has to come from somewhere, and it's not like there are a whole lot of other Democratic profiles encouraged in the Senate. So,
right. And it's never too late for them to start.
So. Yeah, absolutely. You know, life begins at 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or wherever you want it to. Now, up at workingforchange.com, the column that I do every day, the column that's up right now has a number of reasons why the war against Iraq is a bad idea. I, you know, won't go through all of them here, but if anybody is lacking for reasons in Iraq, rationales, they can certainly check that. And I think Counterspin mentioned that Stephen Zunis, who's a very fine Middle East analyst who used to live over here on Bainbridge Island, has been down in San Francisco at USF for several years. He has actually a fairly similar article. I think he has seven reasons why the war is a bad idea, and I have eight, and I'm anxious to get home and compare the lists. But you know, there are any number of reasons. The workingforchange.com column also has a thing you can click on to send a letter to your senators, but, you know, emails is not enough. You know, that's too easy, and office staffs usually don't count them as much as they count handwritten letters, phone calls, office visits.
And you should be talking to people that you run into on a daily basis, you know, as well. That's really one of the things I think is lacking and that I'm working in my own, you know, personal life on is, you know, family members, things like that.
Yeah.
People that normally are not engaged in politics at all.
Those
are the people
outside
that really
the choir.
Need to speak up.
Yeah, and it's very true. That's the other half of that beyond the lobbying, you know, that's to raise the level of debate, but ultimately the opposition has to come from the public. You know, the public has to lead on this one, because the leaders certainly won't. And that involves talking with everyone you know, talking with friends, talking with coworkers, talking with relatives, talking with other people in your classes, you know, strangers on the street. Won't you buy my newspaper? Oh, and by the way, buy some flowers, and have you heard about the war in Iraq? You'll be spending $5 a gallon for your SUV. you know, there are just so many reasons this is a bad idea. I mean, it's a bad idea just from the self-interest of the United States. But there's a very interesting, in one of the ways, incidentally, that it's a bad idea, and we can also talk about the precedence this sets in general, not just for the Middle East, but for the rest of the world. We saw in the wake of 9/11 how the entirely invented doctrine from the Bush administration of you know, being able to send troops in against a country that is quote unquote harboring terrorists. Well, India did the same thing with Pakistan afterwards. Israel did the same thing on the West Bank. Russia did the same thing in Chechnya and then in Georgia, where they claimed Chechen rebels were hiding. You know, so you have the potential for a dynamic after a U.S. invasion of Iraq of all of these wars that are going on all around the world. There are, I think, 60 or so of them right now. So, you know, you have all of these countries in various levels of low or high simmer to raging conflicts. You know, suddenly you have a precedent of a country saying, well, you know, I think another country might pose the risk of invading us down the road, so we're going to invade them. I mean, it could just open the doors in really, really ugly ways.
Yeah. Not necessarily even invading, just attacking, which is pretty broad, you know, right there.
But then the other country is going to return fire, and of course we've been selling them weapons, and we, because the United States walked away from arms control agreements for the last several months, most countries around the world that have any kind of a military establishment have been looking against, you know, ways to defend themselves against weapons from the United States. So, you know, that sort of weapons of mass destruction proliferation is a global problem at this point. You know, Iraq is probably the least likely country to have those kind of weapons because they know they'll be inspected. Most other countries don't. It's a can of worms.
And if we talk about harboring terrorists, the United States has to put itself in that same boat. All the different generals and For instance, from El Salvador, from Central America, from Southeast Asia.
I mean, you know, anybody could invade South Florida on that pretext, or you know, wherever Hank Kissinger is living these days, or, you know, for that matter, most of our former secretaries of state and president. I thought the brouhaha over the German justice minister making comments about the, you know, Bush administration doing some of the same things that Hitler had done in the past, and I mean, it's accurate. You know, it's not saying that they are or that's the direction that it will go, but it is very, very accurate to say they're using some of the same techniques and some of the same justifications. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole idea of preemptive attack, the whole idea of us against the world, and you know, we have a unique and you know, moral superiority and virtuousness that enables us to pass judgment on any country anywhere. I mean, it's an arrogance that can lead to some very, very frightening actions. Would almost certainly lead to increased anti-Americanism, anti-American terrorism, broader regional war. Israel would be fairly likely to use it to even further escalate attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, you know, we see Arafat trapped in his compound again this week. I mean, it's you know, what it would do to oil prices and the economy, and I mean, you just go down the list, and it's a nightmare. But the other side of it, a very interesting document for folks who are interested. The New York Times did a tremendous public service by posting this on their website yesterday. It's a very long URL, so I'm not going to give it over the air. But the title, and you can do a search engine and find it, or it's actually in yesterday's edition, September 20th. Bush's National Security Strategy, and this is a document. It was 30 pages when I printed it out of the report by the Bush administration to Congress that is due to be handed to Congress next week. That basically lays out the Bush administration foreign policy. It's not asking Congress for permission or anything. It's basically just as a report. This is what we're doing. And, you know, give George Bush and the people working for him credit. They are brutally honest in this document. They lay it out. I mean, not honest except for that little line where they say that, you know, we never act in United States unilateral self-interest. Of course that's what they're doing. But, and I would argue it's not even in long-term self-interest, but, you know, most empires that overreach and then collapse don't think that they're not acting in their self-interest when they overreach. It basically is a declaration of war against the world. It is saying, I think it's something like if another country does not believe in, I believe the list is democracy, freedom, free enterprise, and free trade, basically saying, you know, if you don't allow us to come in and plunder you, we reserve the right to invade you at any time, for any reason, at a time of our choosing, by a means of our choosing. I mean, it is very explicit. I mean, it's just paragraph after paragraph after paragraph of, you know, exactly the sort of rationalizations you could see Adolf Hitler and his advisors making. I mean, it is very, very frightening stuff. And, you know, when you see things like that and when you hear stories like you hear from the guests you had on at 7:30 and that will be told at Town Hall today, you realize we live in a country that is, I think, a very good country. It is a country that was founded by some ideals that it has not historically lived up to all the time, but which are ideals that inspire the world. But a country that at this very moment is being taken in some very, very frightening and bad directions. And, you know, I mean, I think there are a lot of people around the world that would like to see it slowed down and stopped and reversed. But, you know, the people in this country are the people who have to take ultimate responsibility for doing that.
So in a document like that where a lot of people will be rallying around, well, it says democracy in there, and that's a good thing to support. The thing is that those items that you listed, democracy, freedom, free enterprise, commas in between those, and it's that this administration will act on just one of those. And
yes.
Use that, like, free enterprise, I think, will be probably the top one that they'll be moving in on. You know, it's like, well, you know,
we've certainly seen that democracy is not a high priority in terms of particularly who they cozied up to after 9/11. And, you know, democracy also is a very, very slippery word, as for that matter, words like freedom and free enterprise and free trade are, too. I mean, you know, if this country believed in free trade, we wouldn't have the Farm Bill and steel price supports and any number of other things that we do. We wouldn't have Boeing, for goodness sake.
Or Microsoft.
But, you know, beyond all that, you know, democracy is not about having two rather than one person on the ballot. It's about having a free exchange of ideas. Which, you know, yes, there's a better chance than there would be in some countries, although not necessarily not something we can take for granted in this country that you and I won't be shot once we step out from this radio station. But you know, so we have a right to speak our mind as long as it's not too widely heard, and we have a right. You know, we had a ballot this week in which on some of the ballot areas there were two people rather than one. Not that most folks knew anything about either of those people, or that they represented a wide spectrum of choice. But, you know, democracy is not about how you elect leaders. It's about how you conduct a society. And when you have significant segments of our society, and this is what the town hall event is about today, and we should talk about that a little bit further, too. When you have significant segments of our society, number one, that are already behind bars, over 2 million people behind bars, over 6 million people entangled in one way or another in our legal system, when you have significant numbers of people who other people think might look like people who might be terrorists, whatever that means. I mean, you and I look a fair amount like Timothy McVeigh to some people, and nobody stops us on the street. But when you have people like that in fear of literally being picked up on the sidewalk one day and never being seen again by the people in their lives, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean about where we are as a society? What does that mean that no significant leadership voices are raised in doubt or opposition when history-making policies are announced or intentions are announced, such as an invasion of Iraq, where the justifications are breathtakingly flimsy, the downside is breathtakingly horrid. You know, the whole enterprise is illegal every which way but Sunday, and it's not even debated in any meaningful way by most of our media apparatus, by most of our political leadership. You know, give people like Jim McDermott an awful lot of credit for standing up. And I've certainly had my quarrels with him in the past, but I'll give him props on this one, because, you know, it's not just a matter of taking a convenient pot shot at an opposition's political leader. He's taking on his own party this time, and that is not something historically he has done in his career.
Yes, so with all The people, our listeners will be calling this week. Jim McDermott's office is one of them that you can call and praise him.
And I do want to say again and give the details, since I've alluded to it a couple times. The event at Town Hall from 10:30 to 1:30 this afternoon is a number of the immigrant communities, and not just immigrants in the sense of being foreign-born, but people who are U.S. citizens, people who were born in this country, but who have different skin colors or different religions, or for one reason or another feel that they can and have been singled out, are going to be giving public testimony about what they've been experiencing in the last year. And I know some of those stories. One of the stories that will be told today in particular is one that I've been working on for a number of months for a cover story coming up for the Weekly. And I mean, the stories are just incredible. You would not believe that things like that could happen in this country. I mean, if you study your history, you would believe that it could happen. But I think a lot of people would be surprised that it could happen in the 21st century. And that's free, open to the public, 10:30 to 1:30, Town Hall. It is definitely not a feel-good kind of event. In the words of one of your 7:30 guests, it's not a kumbaya kind of event. But it will have you leaving determined to do something to change it and to change where we are now.
Yeah, and that's what people need to be doing. Yeah,
very much so. So we have that. We have the war in Iraq. We have the Middle East deteriorating once again with Yasser Arafat once again surrounded by Israeli troops, because, you know, after all, their big brothers in D.C. are saying that they're going to go after a terrorist. They consider Yasser Arafat a terrorist, and so they're going to go after him again. I mean, there really is a ripple effect from what the Bush administration decides is an acceptable course of events to other countries and other leaders who sort of, you know, would like permission or would like a precedent before they go and do what they feel are in their interest as well.
Not that they're always looking for permission when Israel does anything these days.
No,
but
not at all.
It just gets worse.
Yeah, it does. So I'm sorry this has been kind of a grim rant for the last 20 minutes, but it is true.
Well, perhaps then we could move along to some other subject matter.
Sure,
there's another event coming up today.
Yes, there is, and in fact, it's the one that I'm rushing off to right away so that I can get over to Town Hall afterwards for the last part of that. But there is a state convention this morning here in town at the School of Social Work. In fact, it starts in a few minutes at 9 o'clock. But I'm sure they'd be happy if you get there a little bit late. The activists who have been really instrumental in opposing and slowing down, and in some cases stopping, corporate presence in our schools, in our public schools, advertising, sponsorships, all sorts of, you know, insinuous little ways in which corporations are trying to advertise to a literally a captive audience, which is to say, you know, our kids, the people who by statute have to be in a public school X number of hours a day, and while they're there, you know, the government is taking money and pitching them products, whether it's you know, posters on the wall or free book covers or their lesson plans or whatever it is. And at the same time that this convention is happening, it goes from I believe until 9 until 1 today. At the same time that that this is happening, and this is a group, the local host group, Citizens Campaign for Commercial Free Schools, was the group that really was instrumental in having the Seattle School District reverse itself over the last 5 years, from the point under John Stanford where they are actively courting corporate sponsors for our schools, to a point last year where they passed a policy which, while it was not ideal, was still pretty precedent-setting in its own right and on a national level for saying, you know, we will not allow corporate advertising in our schools. However, at the same time, there was also a hotly contested contract that was signed about 3 years ago with Coca-Cola to give Coke exclusive vending machine rights in our schools. And one of the activists with CCCS reported last week that they had sort of confidentially told to them by an employee in the school district that the school district is negotiating for a renewal of that contract, which doesn't expire until 2004, with Coca-Cola for exclusive vending rights. without any kind of public process, that the school district would just announce it as a fait accompli without any kind of hearings, public review, any of this sort of thing. That hit the fan. Folks spoke at the school district board meeting on Wednesday, which, like half of their board meetings, it's such an incredibly hostile forum in which the public has to come and, you know, petition the royal court of the school board. But it was held in the middle of the afternoon, so there weren't a whole lot of people there because people do have to work or go to school or pick up their kids. But imagine that. There were some people there testifying about that and giving the board grief, and I think that'll become a bigger deal. But one of the interesting things that has happened in the past 3 years since that initial contract was announced is that several school districts have taken the precedent-setting step of banning soda, soft drink, vending machines from the schools. Los Angeles did it just about a week and a half ago. Oakland did it a little while ago. It has become a renewed emphasis on nutrition in our schools, and it's a combination of concern about corporate advertising and concern about obesity among our youth and bad nutrition and bad health practices, and what are we teaching our kids in school if we're asking them to drink sugar water every day. And, you know, I don't know if how many people listening have actually been in Seattle's schools, but among the shortcomings of the physical plan, and what I've been told is this is very intentional, there are no drinking fountains. You know, if you want water and you're a student in Seattle schools, you have to, you know, you buy bottled water from the cafeteria, or, you know, buy milk, and, you know, many of the kids in our schools are lactose intolerant, a lot of people of color are, or you buy soda. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the choices the kids have. They don't have fruit drinks, they don't have other stuff that would be healthier for them. So that's an issue that we're going to hear a lot more about.
A lot of them do have drinking fountains, but they just haven't been maintained over the last, you know, 30, 50 years.
Yeah, that's
so,
true,
you know,
too.
You turn them on, and there's like this little tiny dribble coming out
of brown water. Yeah.
You know, water that probably is still a lot better than what the people in Iraq drink currently.
That's very true. But yeah, at least it goes from and goes to, you know, sewage treatment plants. But at the same time, you know, that is true. There are some schools, and I know there are some schools where there are just no drinking fountains at all. It's amazing. I mean, that's a physical plant issue in general with our schools too, where some of them, you know, it's an incredible amount of money being poured into our schools. And a lot of it disappears into administration, the physical upkeep, and, you know, you had the walkout last spring by students at Rainier Beach, and from what I'm hearing, that may be happening again this fall, because, you know, kids and teachers are having to buy textbooks on their own, they're having to buy school supplies on their own. It's like, where's the money going?
So this campaign that Citizens Campaign for Commercial Free Schools is actually a very good success story and example.
It is. It's remarkable
how a limited number of people change things.
Yeah, the woman who is, I think, probably the most visible public face of the campaign, and actually I'm going to write about her a little bit in the Weekly next week, Rita Butler-Wall, a woman we both know. And she was basically, you know, your prototypical soccer mom a few years ago, and she got concerned about this issue and started looking into it a little bit more, and lo and behold, she got sucked into the world of activism, and darn if she isn't an awfully good activist. She has, you know, she's articulate. She stands up for what she believes in. She believes in all the right things, and she has, and, you know, the people that have gathered around her and around the group. I don't want to say it's just her by any stretch. There's a lot of good people in the group, but I mean, it really is a remarkable story of a couple things. Number one, a success story by activists, and number two, a story of how people who, you know, didn't really have any experience with the political system, so nobody told them that this wasn't a democracy. They just assumed that it was. And when they started hitting brick walls by people in positions of power who didn't feel they had to be accountable, they just kept kicking at the brick walls until they tumbled. I mean, it really was a remarkable story, not just of, you know, victory on policy issues, but also empowerment of citizens who weren't particularly politically active or politically sensitized, but who saw a problem, decided to go and fix it, and got politicized in that process. And, you know, Brita has gone on, and I think she's been on the statewide board of the Green Party and done this and done that. And, I mean, she's a dynamo, and several other people in the group are too.
All right, so we've got two events for people to go to today.
Yeah.
They get their choice. They can go to one or the other.
Yeah. Afraid so.
Can't stay at home, though.
No, not at all. Unless you're doing it because you're making phone calls to Congress. That's the other option.
That's right. That's the only thing that'll get you out of this one. So
yeah,
otherwise,
I mean, you know, if you got to work, if you got kids, you got to babysit. I mean, then none of that cuts it. You just leave it all behind.
All right. So with that, we are out of time once again. Talking this week with Just Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, columnist with Seattle Weekly, working for change.com. The list goes on and on. Job, tell us, though, where we can find Eat the State.
You can find Eat the State. It is this wonderful little community newspaper that we started several years ago. Maria and I have both been writing for it for several years, and it's free around town, bookstores, cafes, places where you find free periodicals. It's also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. You can also subscribe. I haven't gotten that in a long time, but we do take subscriptions and donations. It's $24 for a year of biweekly issues at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. That's in the paper and on the website, too. Or you can give us a call. The voicemail is area code 206. 206-903-9461. I haven't said it in a while, so
important. You gotta practice that every week.
That's right.
All right. Speaking of which, we will talk with you and Maria both next week.
We will indeed.
All right.